let's get started with our panel. This is actually a panel I've wanted to do for the last 3 years. Andrew and I have talked many times. He's come to my class many times. And I'm really excited to bring Jake and Andrew and Guy and Laura on to talk about a more literate future for us all. So come on up and we'll talk. Jake, do you want to get started with introductions?
Great.
Hi, all. I want to thank Ken and PubWest for inviting me, as well as Andrew for the reference. And I'd like to thank all my panelists for being here with me today and all of you for showing up. And I wanted to take a minute to acknowledge that the hotel we're in and the land we're on is part of the traditional homelands, the unceded homelands of the Multnomah and Chinook tribal peoples, many of the different bands, their descendants of whom are still with us today taking care of the land. And so I just thought it was important to acknowledge that. Thank you. And it's important to acknowledge that history, but also look forward. So I'd like to introduce some of these amazing folks that we have here today. So under the sort of framing idea of ensuring a more literate future for all, first I'd like to introduce Laura Brief, the CEO of 826 National. Laura's worked in the fields of education and social impact for nearly 20 years. Over that time, she's developed a practice of designing, scaling, and leading organizations aimed at developing at leveling the playing field. She's held key leadership positions at some of the most dynamic organizations like the Posse Foundation, Build, First Graduate, Juma Ventures, and Youth Speaks, where she currently serves as board chair. Laura's proud of her role as CEO of 826 National, which works with the largest youth writing network of the country, serving over 80,000 students ages 6 to 18 each year. A former therapist for survivors of trauma, she holds master's degrees in education and counseling psychology from Columbia. Please welcome Laura. Okay, and then Andrew Proctor, the executive director at Portland's very own Literary Arts. He's been the ED since 2009, born and raised in Canada. I didn't know that. You don't have an accent. That's true. I mean, you consciously avoid saying the word about, so maybe that's like... in the UK, he worked in London as a cultural attaché for the Canadian High Commission, and in the UK, he earned an MA in English Lit at the University of East Anglia under the supervision of England's then Poet Laureate, Andrew Motion. From 2000 to 2004, he worked as editor for HarperCollins in New York City, and then as membership and operations director for the Pan American Center, a global literary and human rights organization focused on the welfare of writers and editors. In total, Andrew's worked in the literary world for over 20 years in the governmental, for-profit, and non-for-profit sectors. Welcome, Andrew. And then finally, we have Guy LeCharles Gonzalez, project lead, Panorama Project. He is a key strategist at Freeverse Media and project lead for the Panorama Project. Previously, he was publisher and marketing director for the Writer's Digest, director, content strategy, and audience development for Library Journal and School Library Journal, and founding director of programming and business development for Digital Book World. Welcome, Guy. So first, I'd like to think about the idea of access and engagement to literature, talking about the introduction on the program, talks about being critical to inspiring creativity, fostering literacy, and strengthening communities. And so I'm just wondering if the three of you could talk a little bit about the idea of increasing access to foster creativity and community in your projects.
Thank you so much, Jake, and for that wonderful introduction. And if it's okay with you all, I would love to start with actually telling you a little bit about our work and why we do it and what we believe in and what we're working towards as kind of context for the conversation. Does that sound good? Okay, awesome. First, I'm so excited to be here. It is not often that you get to be at a conference that is full of people who believe in the power of writing. And so being in this room with all of you all is so tremendous, and I'm so excited about it, and really look forward to the day where when 826 students are sitting in those seats and having a huge impact on the publishing industry themselves. So thanks so much for having us. And over the last, I've learned so much in the last day, but the one thing that, a quote that kept coming to my mind is Toni Morrison's famous saying that, and I hope I don't butcher it, maybe I'll look at, if there's a book you really want to read but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it. That's something that is on the walls of all of our 826 centers and that really guides our work. And 826 was built on the premise that brings you to this room. It was built on the concept that writing changes the course of lives, the course of communities, and can change the course of our nation. How many people in this room have had ever heard of 826 before you opened your program? All right. That's has anyone in the room actually volunteered with 826? Awesome. Thank you. That's great. So this is a refresher for most of you in the room, or many of you in the room, but I'll tell you just a little bit. And if you have questions about our program, I'm happy to answer them later. But we were founded in 2002 at 826 Valencia Street in San Francisco by the author Dave Eggers and the educator Nineveh Caligari. And it was built on this idea that writing is a powerful tool for transforming your relationship to self, for advocating for yourself, for your community, and for, of course, a tool for creative expression and a tool that can really change the trajectory of the professional trajectory and the academic trajectory of lives. So from 2002 to that one storefront in San Francisco, we've grown to be, as Jake said, the largest youth writing network in the country. We currently serve 80,000 students around the nation, and we do that through our 9 chapters and through 826 Digital, which is a teacher-facing platform that takes our tried-and-true method of teaching writing and provides it to teachers and classrooms everywhere for free. And each of our chapters has an imaginative storefront. It sounds like many of you have walked through them. They serve as a non-traditional entree for our students and for our community. They're things like a pirate supply shop, or secret agent supply company, or in Brooklyn, it's a superhero supply company. In New Orleans, my favorite concept, it's a haunting supply company so that all the resident ghosts can get their supplies. And those storefronts, like I said, act as a gateway, but they do something far more important than that. We publish about 1,000 books of student writing a year. And what happens in these storefronts is students get to walk in and they get to see their work on the shelf next to the work of their favorite authors, which is pretty tremendous. So that's what we do. Let me tell you what we believe. We think a lot about the question of who gets to learn to write in this country and who doesn't. And what we know and what you know is that writing changes lives. The data tells us so. Our experience working with young people tells us so. But what we also know is that this tool is not equitably distributed across the United States. We think about, just to say a little about how we think about writing, reading as access, but writing as power. And we believe who gets to learn to write in this country is a pretty important and pretty profound question. It influences whose voices are represented in our newspapers, whose voices are represented in our books, whose voices are represented in the boardroom, at policymaking tables. And so the vision we work towards is a United States in which every student gets to have the opportunity to experience the power and the joy of writing. And I'll pause there. I hope that gives you a little context.
Hey, I'm Andrew. Thanks for being here. It's fun to have this in our hometown again. How many people know about literary arts? You guys sort of... Awesome. So we are a literary center. We're 35 years old. And we're unusual maybe because we have a big part of our work is very public programs based and very public and reader facing. And a big part of our work is with the industry and with writers. We actually have our own endowment that funds both independent publishers and independent and writers themselves. And we also teach writing to about 4,000 kids in the Portland Public School District. We have a space downtown, but we very much work on a hub and spoke system, which means that we work in architectures throughout the city and the county and the state. So we go to places in rural parts of Oregon that are considered arts deserts. They have no libraries. They have no cultural services whatsoever. And so that's kind of the basis of our work. We reach about 30,000 Oregonians a year in person and hundreds of thousands. We have our own NPR show here in the Pacific Northwest called The Archive Project. And we work in concert halls. We have a giant book festival. We tour the state, and we just try to continue to adapt the organization to serve as many people as we possibly can with the limited resources that we have here in the state. We'll probably talk about how that we get to that later, but that's kind of the broad overview of the organization. I've been with the organization about 10 years, and in the last sort of while, it's gone through some significant changes in terms of trying to be a more inclusive place and really trying to change the structures within our organization and try to change the structures outside of our organization as such as we can to make the organization and really arts and culture in the city a lot more welcoming. And some of that work has been successful and some of it has not been successful. But it's been a really interesting journey. And the upside is, I'll show you a slide later, is that we, in a very short period of time, doubled the number of people we serve in person. But what's important about that number is we've doubled the number of unique individuals. In other words, we're not serving the same people over and over and over again. We added a whole 100% more people we serve who are entirely new to our organization. We can talk about who they are and how that happened, but that was the sort of, for me, that was the big headline for us. So thanks for being here.
So how many people have heard of the Panorama Project? A lot less, I thought so. How many of you have heard about the McMillan Library Battle? Okay. So the Panorama Project, I joined last summer, but basically it was initially conceived in an attempt to gather and analyze data to really measure the impact of public libraries. And there's a general sense of few people will debate public libraries' importance to both the local culture and communities that they support, but particularly in the context of this, the growth of literacy, the nurturing and development of readers through various writing programs, the nurturing and development of future writers. Most libraries either have their own writing programs or partner with organizations like this to offer them space to produce those writing programs. Excuse me. So Panorama Project initially was trying to data-driven. It's a term I hate because it's kind of been dumbed down and it actually doesn't mean anything anymore. Data-driven, GPS was data-driven. It'd drive you off a cliff if you don't pay attention to where you're going. So what we quickly realized is publishers, A, weren't really that willing to share data with each other. And in a lot of cases, they didn't have the data to share because a little company called Amazon captures a lot of consumer sales data and, oddly enough, doesn't like to share it either. So we made a pivot last summer when I joined to really focus on advocacy and engagement. How many public libraries are in the United States? Anybody know? Over 16,000. How many independent bookstores are in the United States? Allegedly around 2,500. ABA doesn't break out those numbers because what most publishers don't like to know is a lot of those independent bookstores are also second-hand used booksellers, which publishers love less than libraries. So libraries are a critical part of the publishing ecosystem, both for the readers who engage those books through libraries, but more importantly, the kids. The most prominent users of libraries right now are women, mothers of kids. And so they're coming into the libraries through the children's services that libraries offer, whether it's story time, access to books. And they're often becoming library users, again, themselves through those engagements. So two of the biggest populations of current and future readers, libraries are there on the ground floor working with. And there are big publishers who are antagonizing libraries right now. This group, I think you have a unique opportunity, is to engage with libraries, particularly in your relevant regions, to not just sell more books and get more readers, but to really contribute to this more literate future for all, and we'll get into that a little more as we go.
All right, thank you. And so I didn't know that number about the numbers, the breakdown of independent bookstores versus libraries. And I think that since a public library is functions as a third space that's not a workplace or a home, as well as independent bookstores and so many cultural events go on there. Could you talk a little bit about how some of the ways that we can approach both, you know, what libraries carry and what bookstores carry with a, you know, an eye towards representation and increasing kind of the different kinds of books that people see in places like that?
Sure. So from, you know, from my perspective, the opportunity for publishers is there's a lot of interest in, you know, we hear a lot about own voices, diverse audiences. In general, that's just publishing code for not the standard middle-class white woman book club reader. That's really what we're talking about when we talk about diverse audiences and own voices. And sometimes it's not a comfortable conversation to admit that as a publisher, you've prioritized one audience over others. The value of libraries in particular is libraries truly are embedded in their communities. They represent the communities that live in those areas. So I was recently, just as an example, Nashville Public Library. You think of the library as a place people go and maybe more and more access online. Nashville Public Library isn't unique in this way. It's just the most recent example I've got. I'd say about 60% of what Nashville Public Library does, programming-wise, pushes outside of their buildings. As an example, they have a great, it's called Bringing Books to Life. It's a program that they've developed to teach early childhood education centers and providers how to do story time, how to take books and make them teaching tools, how to connect books to other books. So they develop book lists. And because they're serving these specific audiences, so one example, they have a big puppet show history that they've been doing puppet shows for about 70 years at that library. They've got one of the largest Kurdish communities, and I think the largest Kurdish community in the United States. They polled that community, and the kids wanted a puppet show production of Ali Baba. So what their standard process is they produce a show, they find a book that relates to that show, they give that book, usually up to 500 copies, to the early childhood centers in that area. And that becomes a book that those centers have, that the library circulates. They couldn't find a relevant Ali Baba story for kids. A lot of adult-oriented ones, a lot of out-of-print ones. They actually had to go produce their own book. They had to license a publisher who had an out-of-print version to update it themselves because no publisher thought it was important enough to serve that community themselves. So when libraries are going out of their way to publish for segments of their community, that's a huge gap publishers are leaving behind. And I guarantee you that one Kurdish community isn't the only community looking for those books. So part of the value of libraries is, you know, for publishers who are like, oh, I don't know how to find those audiences, start right there. Go to the libraries in your region because they are required to, A, understand their communities, the breakdown. They use census data. They use their own access to data. They know who those communities are. They know what they're looking for. So as publishers, that's an easy way to engage directly with libraries in your community. If you claim you want to reach other audiences, start right there. Libraries, unlike Amazon, will very happily engage you and share useful data to help you publish books that people actually want.
And one thing to ping in before Andrew, I also wanted to ask a little bit about some of the efforts in rural communities with libraries in East County. I know Literary Arts does a lot of work in for slam communities and whatnot, and also how we can sort of, I liked what Laura said about cultivating new readers and leadership. I saw one of the past things, and maybe I'll bring that up later, but I went to college with, there was a bunch of posse kids at Vanderbilt, and they were all really smart and well-read, and I don't know, if you're a Filipino that grew up in Idaho, when you meet Bronx Filipinos, it's a little intimidating.
I can't speak to that part of it. I guess that part of the change for the organization in terms of being a more inclusive, more welcoming place for many different kinds of people and many different kinds of story, for us was a journey of really changing what our programs were or just eliminating them altogether where they didn't make sense or where they were not inclusive. And what we say to ourselves a lot is, like, mode matters in our world. So there is Portland Arts and Lectures, for example, is a big program of ours. It's in a very fancy concert hall downtown. It has a subscriber base that is 100% white. They've been coming for years and years, and we love them. They're great, but that's never going to change. And so what we found was when we opened a storefront space and made sort of a little town hall space where we said, we're not going to program in this space at all. This is a community space that other people are going to program in, and they're going to tell us what it is that they want, because we had lost so many square feet in this town. We lost so much architecture to public spaces that we were trying to emphatically build a new space, and it wasn't going to be about us, and it wasn't going to be about our programming. That was a move towards really changing, giving up control, giving people space, getting out of the way, using the power that we had to access resources, and then just providing it to somebody else wholesale without attaching any strings to it whatsoever. The festival, we acquired a festival here. It was collapsing under its own financial weight, and we revived it and put it in downtown Portland, which has got its own complicated history. But it was programmed in a way in which 40% of the writers on stage, including interviewers, were people of color. And it meant an emphatic and radical shift in who attended the events we were in. I mean, it seems like, well, duh. But it's really interesting because in this city particularly, having a less white audience, having a more diverse audience, is linked to age, right? So people in my world and often in my job, and this is a comment I hate, is like, well, you know, as an excuse for having a not diverse audience, well, Oregon's only 12.5%. People of color, so, you know, what are you going to do? And, like, that's supposed to be, like, the end of the conversation. And I just think that's baloney. And if you actually look at data and slice it down, we're not data-driven, but we do have some data we use. I'm like, oh, shit, I think I said data-driven earlier. God, so nerve-wracking being on live panels. Is that if you take the data and look at census data in the Willamette Valley, right, and you then say, I want to see everybody under 40, we're 40% populations of color, right? And so if you build a more diverse stage and a more group of speakers and more people on there, you are also going to get a younger audience, which everybody says they want, right? And so if you look at the festival now, our book festival, it's 10,000 people for a single day. 30% of the audience is below the age of 35, right? 10% of the audience is below the age of 18, and that's not counting the toddlers who got dragged there by their parents. I just mean, like, kids come to the event. So those are, like, really interesting learning for us in terms of in a very sort of narrow, like, down to zip code count, you can sort of begin to customize your answer for your specific community. You were talking about specific communities. That's how we sort of really began to learn about the data, and I should shout out to PSU, who was hugely helpful, because I know they were here, Kent's here somewhere, and everybody's, the head of the Ulan Press is here, I think, but they helped us do a lot of really great data work with the festival and really helped us understand what was actually occurring. You could sort of see it, right, and know it. It was young and it was vibrant. It was really exciting, but we couldn't quantify it. So it's really helpful to quantify it. And then the last thing that we've done, that's sort of structural changes to how we program and where we program and who gets to program. And then the last piece of it was just moving away from an organization. And this isn't less relevant, I think, probably as a publisher, but I think it's important for me to say was, we were an organization that said literature is on dead pine trees. That's what literature is, right? And that is a very narrow way of thinking about storytelling. It's a fine way to think about storytelling. I don't have any objections to it. It's very narrow. And when you say our mission, because we get to decide actually what our mission is, it was an interesting revelation when I realized that all I had to do was get the board to vote on a new mission, and we had a new mission. And I was like, shit, it's not biblical? Like, you can just do what you want. I mean, it's so many times I've run up to barriers that I thought were like 100% solid, and I was like, oh, no, we just get to decide, right? If we build consensus for it. I mean, I think that's part of the psychological breakthrough for the organization is you decide what you do with your company. Nobody else does. So that was really empowering, and so we said, actually, you know what? Literature is this broad range of storytelling. We're going to, like, really dig down and really support Youth Slam competitions all across the city, and now we have 1,400 kids come to our all-city high school slam championship. They go to Brave New Voices. They competed last year and placed, which was great because our slam community is a little newer than other cities. We host all kinds of storytelling events, and just like we just change the idea about what our mission is, and it just like it was like all this oxygen came blowing into a stuffy room. It was like so exciting and so exciting to be around and really, really liberating. And so that's kind of the work of like changing ourselves to be a different place. And that's resulted in having different staff members and different board members and different funders. And it's been really exciting. And I've given you all the good stories. I haven't given you all the bad stories. But I'll tell you on beers afterwards if you want the bad stuff. Because there were plenty of, like, I'm making it, and I say that because I'm, like, making it sound like it was all just this long, smooth arc to success. And that's not what it's been at all. And, you know, I don't consider us successful in this matter. I consider us to have made progress. And that's all I would say about it. So maybe that's where I'll stop.
Great. Thank you. If Jake were sitting closer to me, he might kick me under the table for this, because instead of answering the question, if it's okay, I actually would love to turn the question back to you all. Because from where I sit, we work with 80,000 students, 6 to 18, around the U.S., and they're telling their stories, and they're writing their stories. And we know all about the danger of a single story. We know all about how important it is to see reflections of yourself and reflections of folks who have experiences like you in your classroom, in your library. We know that. And what we are trying to figure out is the stories are out there. The writing is out there. Leah Hernandez, who you met a moment ago, is also doing incredible work with young people. Her, these children's books that they're creating are phenomenal. And the question that I have is the same question you asked. How do we then get those stories out there? The writing is there. It's not about producing the stories or producing the writing. It is there in droves. And so what do we do with it? What comes next? And it can be a rhetorical question or up to you, Jake. Great.
I don't want to get into any of the particulars about the whole American Dirt brouhaha, but I was having facilitating a conversation. Sorry?
I said talk about it.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was trash. No. well, I mean, there were just so many failures the whole way, and the problem's much more systemic than simple fix would let us believe. But I was talking to the poet Javier Zamora, who wrote a book unaccompanied about his experience as a 10-year-old crossing the border. And he was telling me that, you know, in decades past, there was a similar kind of groundswell of support for kind of social justice, movement-related arts, and that connection between that, but it wasn't sustained, and so it went through a low period, and now we're in this period again. And what can we do as sort of gatekeepers and as people with some kind of access to be able to ensure that it's sustained a little bit more, a little bit better? What do you guys think?
So I really like that point about your mission is yours. So the belief that, oh, I don't know how we do this, it's by deciding to do it and prioritizing it. And so a quick little story, 20 plus years ago, I was in the poetry slam scene, the adult scene before the kids scene really blew up. And I was also at the same time working for the Academy of American Poets. In my interview, my final interview before I got the job, they were aware of my slam poetry activities. Anybody heard of the New Eureka Poets Cafe in New York City? That's where I was, like, kind of cutting my teeth. I was explicitly told, you know, if you get this job, it doesn't mean the Academy is endorsing the poetry slam stuff. We just need to be really clear that your external activities don't have anything to do with what's happening at the Academy. I was like, whatever, dude, I just want the job. and back then, the Academy was in the midst of a number of controversies around their lack of diversity in their chancellors, their lack of diversity on the board, a whole lot of nepotism in who got awards, and there was a coincidental factor, they were all white. So, but one of the interesting things was what was happening in that poetry slam community was a lot of amazing work that was going completely ignored by the traditional publishers. Jonathan Galassi, the head of FSG, was also the chairman of the board for the Academy of American Poets. And I did an article for Poets and Writers at one point about the growth of the slam, and I got my boss, the executive director of the Academy, on record to be like, hey, the slam scene is amazing. They're doing things we can't do. They're reaching people we can't do. He fucking got in trouble and almost lost his job because Galassi lost his mind that the executive director of the Academy of American Poets publicly said anything positive about Poetry Slam. But what was happening there was this category of books that, if it sold 2,000 copies, was a huge success, completely ignoring this under this subculture, this community that was locked out of the gates, and ultimately went on to create their own presses. Right Bloody Press, Soft Skull back then. There were a number of presses that came up by saying, you know what? We're going to publish the people in this community. Fast forward like 15, 20 years later, they're your big prize winners. They're the poets you're talking about. Patricia Smith, Ocean Vuong, these poets who came out of that scene that was completely dissed and ignored because our mission didn't include that audience. So when we talk about things like American Dirt, you know, American Dirt is a systemic problem. There was a decision to put a shit ton of money behind a lousy-ass book to tell a story that they deemed important, but they thought, hey, we need this woman to tell the story, ignoring the books that were already out there, or to your point, the number of voices who could have told that story better, and probably wouldn't have needed a seven-figure advance to do it. So that point about your mission, it's as publishers, you make that decision what audiences to serve, and more importantly, what audiences to not serve. And the ones you choose to not serve, Aaliyah Hernandez is going to come along and eat your lunch. So.
I want to just key on the word sustain. How do we sustain the work? Because I think that you know, my organization is a historically white organization. It was disinterested in other populations besides the white population. I think that's undeniably a fact, and it's a reckoning and a conversation that I've had with prior board members, prior staff members, and those folks over the years. And like, no one's proud of that, and that's just, but it's also just a reality that's really important for us to acknowledge. That's the place that we're coming from. And in the transition to doing more work with many more people in our community and many more communities within our community, because I think that's also how it works, there was a lot of fear in my organization about sustaining the work and about who was going to fund it and all these kinds of things. And, you know, myself included probably, because I was a new director and it was, you know, I didn't know the community and I didn't know what was going to happen. Anyway, the point is, fast forward a lot time after that, it's for every funder that we lost that, like, was scared of the work or didn't understand it or thought we were going the wrong way, two more arrived. We didn't know they were going to arrive, and that's the terrifying part, right? It's sort of like, it made me feel like, I don't know, like proud of my community in a weird way. Like, I just thought, well, maybe this is naive, and maybe it's my Canadian nature coming out. It was like, oh, if we do some good work and we talk about it and publicize it, and you have to do a lot about it, and you can sort of sustain it for a little while and show some progress, the funding kind of emerged. And it's interesting that the festival has a huge audience. Like, we're not. I don't have any problem. Like, we have a problem. There's too many people at the festival. That's my problem, right? So, like, the audience is there, is 100% there. I mean, we run a youth poetry slam, which is hugely diverse. 1,400 people come to it. It's a youth event. I mean, I have an 11-year-old, okay? His events are boring, okay? But because I'm his dad, I think they're amazing, right? That's just fatherhood. But, like, but so that the idea that you could have in a youth event where, like, regular citizens show up and want to know, it became this thing where it became an exchange. So for me, we're kind of on the other side of that, this part of the journey about how do we sustain the work. And it's like, I don't have any fear about that. You know, I feel really excited, and I feel like a lot of our funders have come along and are really excited and are pushing us hard and challenging us to do actually more of that work. And I feel like the readers are there. You know, our radio show, which has a lot of, you know, writers of color on it. I think Jake's been on the show at different times. He's like, really? I think, you're not supposed to say that, Jake, at the conference. That show, you know, it airs. It's in the worst slot you could imagine. I'm at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday on public radio. Like, I was like, how's this going to work? We have 10,000 listeners a week, right? And that's like, they're not all famous. So, like, I just have a lot of faith in my community, and I have a lot of faith in the integrity of my community. And not everybody's perfect in this community, of course, and there's lots of problems here. But, like, I also was, like, really excited to get to the other place, and I feel like we really just need to come from a place of abundance and not fear with this. And that has really just fundamentally shifted the organization's sort of whole position. And again, we have lots of work to do. We have a lot of work to do, but it just has gotten us in a place where we really feel we can do that work. So that's what I think about sustaining. I have no comment about the whole. Yeah, I don't even have a comment. It's too much, too overwhelming.
One of the approaches that we take to changing the system that we are all operating in and that our students are operating in is by developing partnerships, and partnerships that we think can help lead the way. And an example of that is adjacent to the work that you all do, but not squarely aligned with the work you do, and it is the crisis of local news that we have going on in the United States right now. Local news is dying, as you all know. I mean, what, we lose a local newspaper every, I'm going to exaggerate, but every month it feels like one is shutting down, right? And the impact of not having local news stories being covered is tremendous. We think about the state of our democracy right now, and there is a profound relationship, in my mind, between local news and the state of our democracy, civic engagement, whose stories are told, who is who's active, who's participating, which communities we're looking at, what problems we're solving. And there are young people writing in communities across this country, in the communities that our chapters are in, but then also through digital in rural communities and suburban communities. They're writing stories about their experiences. And so we're working on media, on partnerships with media outlets, so that while we are losing that local news, we're amplifying the stories that are being told in those communities by the young people who live in those communities. That's one of the ways we approach this, is by developing partnerships that we think can sort of shift that system in small but meaningful ways. And we're very much looking for ways to do something similar in the publishing industry. Is how do we develop strategic partnerships that that can serve a similar purpose?
One other thing. I just think that that Cummings book is the reason. There's so many. I totally agree, and I'm stuttering, but like, it's also was just a flat out lie from the start to the finish. It was so condescending to every reader in this country, right? Like her husband was a first generation. It was just a straight-up lie, and they all knew it. And that has just profoundly compacted the problem of appropriation in all of this, where it was just like, you know, how dumb do you think we are as readers? I mean, that's what I'd ask the publisher. Like, you didn't think people were going to figure that out? It's really profoundly dumb for an organization that's been doing that work for so long. And it is a systemic problem, I agree. But I just, for me, that's what my first reaction was. This is just such a lie.
Yeah, and how do you not have anybody in any of those rooms say, no, maybe we shouldn't do this way or at all?
Irish!
In the marketing and everything. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I remember reading something by Miriam Gerba that talked about, if you split that $1 million advance up to like 40 Latinx artists or something like that for whatever, what could you do?
Right.
And I think that's should we open it up to the audience for the last few minutes?
Anecdote that just when we're talking about flipping the system, we had an event at 826 New Orleans not too long ago with two writers who care a lot about the organization, Walter Isaacson and Michael Lewis. And the event, we usually put our students front and center, and they're reading from their books. And for this event, we flipped it a little bit. And so our students were interviewing these two writers about their experiences. So imagine 6, 7, 8-year-olds interviewing Walter Isaacson and Michael Lewis. And I love the last question that was asked by a 7-year-old was, wait a minute, I don't understand how you're a published author. You didn't come through 826. And so.
All right. So we're an organization of small to medium-sized publishers. How can we help you guys?
I mean, for us, I would just say, publish more diverse voices, like period, paragraph. I mean, one of the ways we thought about the work that we do, and we exist between the academy and the library in this sort of interesting public space. And we fund the work. We give Oregon Book Awards to published work. And it's impossible for us to control who's published in Oregon, and so it's very hard for us to do good inclusion work in that program. We can hire judges who are more diverse, and we do that, but the pool is the pool of books published. And so where we put all our energy, right, when we're talking about being inclusive, is in the fellowship side of the work, where we're giving money for the completion of manuscripts. And we've reserved a lot of the money that we give away now only for writers of color because they've been historically underpublished. So a lot of our money goes only to women who have been historically underpublished and to writers of color, and they need publishers. And the work is there. Like, no Oregon publisher should look at me and say the work isn't there, because we see the work every day. It is there. It's not always being published. And that you guys are such an important part of the ecosystem, and I admire the work that you do, because it's like, I'm sure, like vertigo inducing like every day, and all of your stars get stolen by the bigger presses. But we need you guys to publish those writers so that those writers can continue on their professional journey. It's just so important. And so our piece of it, our contribution to that, is to try to fund that work as best we can. And our fund's been growing in that pool. But we're not a publisher, and we're probably not ever going to be a publisher for a variety of reasons. So I need partners who are looking at that work, and it's there. And we need to get published, and we need to get out there. So that's where I see our role in the ecosystem, and maybe your role.
For Panorama, what we're looking for, the Big Five is the Big Five. They've got their issues. They've got their metered access and stuff. You guys are in a unique position to basically fill gaps. So from a strategic perspective, I want you to work more collaboratively with libraries, particularly in your regions. You know, start there. Don't think that, we've got some national library distribution magic that's going to come. But on a specific level, any of you that already engage with libraries and have some good stories to tell, or are willing to dig deeper into data and really actually share some specific data, not like on your whole operation, but if you've got a few titles that either you found some success in libraries or you have no clue because you're three times removed from what's happening in the library space, reach out to me and talk, because there are ways to kind of dig into that data to figure out, A, what's actually happening with your books in libraries and what impact it's having on consumer sales, and whether or not there are things you can do to improve that. But by being willing to collaborate and work directly with libraries, you're helping to strengthen the ecosystem that right now, frankly, is under attack by at least one big publisher in a very significant way.
I'd like to add also that I do listen to the show. And I love the Robin Cost Lewis episode from when she did the arts and lectures. I still go back every few months and listen to that one. If you haven't had the chance, it's amazing. I just meant that I hadn't listened to mine. I didn't know that my little one poem before Claudia Rankine was part of that recording. And
you signed the release. I don't know. I can't.
That's true. Okay. Touche. And also, yeah, thank you, full disclosure, for the I know that the fellowships, any amount of resources, even if it's like a $100 fellowship, $500 fellowship, you know, I won one a couple years ago through Literary Arts to work on my manuscript, and it made a huge difference. And I know, you know, publishing costs being what they are, even like a few scholarships is submittable costs, like for writers of color, for underrepresented writers, it can make a huge difference. So any more questions?
The community I live in, which is Missoula, Montana, which is sort of a lot like a mini Portland in Montana. We're the liberal center of our state. We have a book festival. I went to my first poetry slam at that book festival. It was a transformative experience. It was held in a bar in downtown Missoula. As part of that, as part of the Montana Book Festival, we also hosted for several years a wonderful event called Pie and Whiskey, where your ticket gets you a slice of homemade pie and a shot of whiskey, and you get to hear stories all evening long that somehow are related to pie and whiskey. But one of the things that I had happen to me last December, Missoula voted themselves to tax themselves to build a new library. It's going to be beautiful. It opens this June. In December, I had the opportunity to be in a group of folks and talk to some people that I have known for a very long time that absolutely blew me away because they said, why the hell are we spending all this money building a library when we've got Google and Amazon? We could have bought everybody in town a new iPad, and they would have been just fine. It's just going to be a gargantuan homeless shelter. And I was so flabbergasted, I didn't know what to say initially. I was just, the gulf in our communities and our society between the sort of thinking that that represented to me and where I was at, it just seemed like there was nothing, I knew immediately there was nothing I was going to be able to say that would change their mind. And I suspect that this gulf exists across our country. And I'm just wondering if any of you have any possible solutions on how we begin to bridge that.
So from a library perspective, that is a very common complaint that libraries field. And you know, the best answer that librarians tend to give is we serve our entire community. And that includes the homeless members of the community. It tends to be a negative stereotype of libraries, and the conflation of, oh, it's a homeless shelter and can't we just give everybody iPads? Like that right there kind of tells you the mindset. There's a segment of our society that is okay to serve, and there's a segment that it's okay to leave behind. So by putting those two statements together, that's almost the kind of person there's no real debate to be had because they've already decided there's members of their community who aren't worth serving, and you know they're framing it in some coy way. But at its core, that is the true value of libraries. Libraries do not discriminate when it comes to access. Google does. Apple does. That fucking iPad you're going to have to replace in 3 years. L.A. School District about 5 years ago had a whole boondoggle. They were going to spend $500 million fucking dollars on iPads while laying off $500 million worth of teachers in the same fucking budget year. All right? A year later, they finally – excuse my language – a year later, they finally.
I'm offended. Yeah.
A year later, they finally scrapped it and killed it. But that was those were the priorities. iPads were more valuable than teachers. So the pushback there is first and foremost, libraries serve the entire community. And if you can't accept that, then there's really no conversation to be had with those people because they don't actually care about the community overall.
Can I also? There's a. Can I just jump in? Awesome. Yeah. Yes. The Metropolitan Group, which is a political PR polling company, which why the hell am I bringing that up? I know. But they did some – they do pro bono work every 2 years, and they've been doing this big national work around arts and culture. This is an adjacent answer, but it's relevant to your question, I think. And they did all this polling around the language of arts and culture, right? And, arts and culture language, in dominant culture is very white language. And then they did this study in Eastern Oregon. And this is where things, I thought, got kind of interesting because Eastern Oregon is a much more conservative place, certainly than Portland, and is a very red part of our state.
Idaho's actually trying to annex Eastern
Oregon. I don't even... Well, I mean, in the, we have the Bundys. It's a crazy town out here. But what was really interesting was they did some polling and they had these ranchers do these focus groups, and this is where things got weird. They would say in one group, like to this group, what do you think about arts and culture? Well, it's city things, and I don't care about that, and it's for liberals, and no one, that's not for me. And they find, and then they'd come back the next day and they do some more talking, and they say, kind of just tell us about your day and your week and how you spend your time. And they talk about their work, and then they were like, oh yeah, and then I built the set for my daughter's high school play, and I play in the band for the choir, and I sing at every Christmas concert, and I like all of this stuff, which holy shit, half this guy's time is in some way involved in arts and culture, but he would never call it that, right? And so you know, I don't have an answer for the question, but the language that we're using in these communities is a failed set of language. And simply saying it again is not going to get you any further, right? And so I think there are totally lost causes. And, like, there's no point spending any time. But I also think my community of arts and culture leaders are totally failing, right, to frame what our work in ways that are relevant. Because what we're seeing is that a lot of those individuals, when you look at data, sorry, when you look at the data, they are actually, like, they're involved in their churches, they're involved in their schools, they're, like, really active, like, community members you would want, right? They're, like, not just going to work and going home. Like, all those stereotypes, like, all that stereotype, it's just, it's so unuseful and so unhelpful. And that the language we've used to exclude slam poetry, to make people feel stupid, to use words that people don't understand so that they won't think it's for them. That is, our language is so loaded with that we're not even aware of it, I don't think, at all times. I'm speaking for myself only. And we've got to, like, deconstruct that language if we think we're going to be a more inclusive place in all of the different ways that can mean. And it does have a powerful meaning in the state of Oregon, where it's radically rural, and, you know, there's a real antithesis to Portland, you know, that we're going to have to figure out if we're going to, like, live in a whole state and not get annexed by Idaho, which would be really weird. You had a question, I think, too, didn't you?
It's not really more of a question, but more of a comment. I think we're talking a lot about, like, how do we find these diverse stories, and I was sat on the Head of House Publishers Roundtable yesterday, and I think that that will be a question for a lot of the publishers, is how do you find these groups of people? And I think the number one answer is staffing. And if you don't have any diverse people on your staff, we talked a lot about we need to grow our staff and build our teams. And I think the way that you get these diverse audiences is by having diverse people on your team. And if you don't have anyone that's diverse on your team, then you're really not making that a priority, because you're not going to find them. So that's all I had. Not a question.
We should take one or two more, and then we need to wrap up because we got food and booze in the exhibit hall.
So I want to say quickly about the libraries. There's a photo project going on by Robert Dawson about photographing libraries across the United States and then around the world. And these pictures, when you see these libraries, from Quonset hunts to the fine libraries in the cities, you start to feel the jewels that they are. And we just built a new library in our town. And one of the things we did is we had a closing of the old library where we all got together and told the story. And they even let us write our stories on one of the walls of one of the rooms before they took down the old library. And so we have photographs of all of these stories that people came in and wrote with magic markers about what that library had meant to them. And it had to be replaced by a new space, and the new space is finally open, and it's gorgeous. And I think if you can bring those stories of why the library is important, we can really value that space again.
Laura, I really liked what you had to say about engaging young people with the news and the decline of our news industry. And libraries are a fantastic community resource. They reflect our communities. But another institution that's also really been weakened a lot in the last couple of decades is student journalism in our schools, and there are so few school newspapers anymore. And part of that is because it tends to reflect the greater culture. And, you know, like, newspapers, what were they, is like a history lesson that you can do with young people. But the idea of telling those stories and having young people write for audience with purpose. And when you talk about, like, Andrew, when you talked about, like, the demographics of the state as it goes younger, and trying to pull voices out of those communities, I'm wondering how much bandwidth there is in all of your missions to include our schools and student journalism as another way of sort of just creating this more literate environment with more voices that are coming from the ground up and speaking directly to their peers in order to create a new generation of writers and readers. And I'm wondering if you could speak about that a little bit.
Yeah, you're speaking our language. So we have writers' rooms in schools in the nine cities we operate in. And one of the things that happens in these writers' rooms is student journalism. And so sometimes that looks like a student magazine, sometimes it looks like a student newspaper, but it's something that we really also see the power of and are invested in, and our students are invested in. And I think that, yes, there is, it is a dying thing, but there's hope. I don't know if you saw a couple of months ago, there was an article in the Times about how student newspapers are actually taking the place of local news because they have a different funding model than the news industry. They can work with the endowment of a university or with other funds if it's on a high school level, and they're able to step in and really, if they train the students well and give students the tools and the opportunity, those students are able to tell the stories that are being lost because of the loss of local newspapers. So it's something that we are deeply invested in and want to do more of. And we want to not only work with student newspapers, but get our students into the larger national newspapers.
Just one quick thing on school libraries. There are a number of school libraries across the country who school librarians in particular take digital literacy very seriously. And there are a number who have established programs where it's not quite full-on student newspapers, but the structure is encouraging students to pursue journalism. So there's, you know, they tend to be mostly digital and within the school environment. But school librarians have really taken that to heart as a thing that they can nurture. Unfortunately, school librarians are also being let go more and more across the country. So it's kind of a catch-22. The interest and activities are there, but the people who are driving it are increasingly losing their jobs.
It could happen in libraries, too.
It could. And there's a few outlier examples of that, particularly some public library makerspaces have turned publishing initiatives into things. And, you know, as an example, as publishers yourselves, that's a very, you know, that's a really important thing for you. Reach out to your, you know, whatever your main public library is. If they have a makerspace, volunteer to establish a publishing program to actually make that a goal of what you do and make that, you know, again, your mission is your mission. If that's important in your community, maybe that should be part of your mission and carve out 5% of your budget to that, because what you're doing is creating future writers, literate children who are going to grow up to then become readers and consumers of your books.
Thank you all. We really appreciate the information. And let's carry on the conversation. The exhibit hall, please, everybody come over. I spent a fortune on food. There's a cash bar. Come on over. Appreciate it. And before we all leave, we raised over $500 already, so we're a quarter of the way for scholarship. Thank you. And extra. Thank you. Thank you, guys.